Hello, and welcome back to KHN's What the Health. I'm your host, Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News. I'm joined by some of the best and smartest health reporters in Washington. We're here to bring you the latest in news about health policy from the White House, Capitol Hill, federal agencies, and the states. We're taping in our regular Thursday morning time slot this week on May 3rd. As they say in the business, news happens fast here in Washington, and things might have changed by the time you hear this. So here we go. Today we are joined by Joanne Cannon of Politico.
Hello, everybody.
Margo Sanger-Katz of the New York Times.
Good morning.
And Alice Olstein of Talking Points Memo.
Hello.
And following our discussion, we have an interview with Bob Blendon, Harvard health and polling expert, on how health might really play in the midterm elections in November. But first, the news. Nothing really big this week, but lots of interesting odds and ends. Let's start with Medicaid. Medicare and Medicaid Director Seema Verma had a sit-down with reporters earlier this week. I was out of town, but Alice, you were there. The discussion was mostly about Medicaid, right?
Yes. So there was some reporting that the administration was going to make an announcement at this briefing and decided not to. So it was really just sort of a ask anything you want, although the main focus was these Medicaid work requirements that they are very keen on allowing states to implement and have approved three states already. And there's nearly a dozen in the waiting, including most recently Ohio submitted a waiver request. And so lots of back and forth about that. Now, according to a report from The Hill, what she was going to announce was a rejection of Kansas's proposal to set a three-year lifetime limit on Medicaid enrollment in the state. And that's controversial.
That's why I wanted to talk about this.
May violate the Medicaid statute, depending how that shakes out legally. They did not announce that. So that's still undecided, at least publicly. But there was a lot. It really focused on the work requirements question, which they refer to as community engagement, because it's not just work. It could be volunteering or other things. Sounded open to Medicaid work requirements in non-expansion states, but she emphasized that there will be a different standard for evaluating those because she acknowledged that if folks who are on Medicaid in those states that did not expand are forced to find work, they will then earn too much to qualify for Medicaid and then fall into the coverage gap where they can't afford a private plan, even with subsidies. And she says she'll take that into consideration.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big sort of ways that this might fall apart legally is that if Medicaid parents or caretakers of Medicaid eligible children are by law also eligible for Medicaid, although not at the same threshold. And a lot of states have these really, really low thresholds.
38% of poverty in Kansas,
and it's even lower in some states. So pretty much any kind of work will boost them above that. So basically you're saying, well, you have to work, but if you have to work or we'll take away your Medicaid, but if you work, we'll take away your Medicaid because now you're earning too much money.
But you still aren't earning enough to afford even the cheapest plan.
Right. You might be earning 39% of poverty.
Right.
Which is,
I just wanted to recommend.
But if they're below 100% of poverty, they're not even eligible for the subsidies. I mean, they fall into this huge hole.
That's the Medicaid gap.
I just want to recommend the Association for Healthcare Journalists recorded this press briefing with Seema Verma. So I wasn't there. I listened to the audio of it. But it's on their website and it's available to the public. And even though some of what we're talking about seems sort of like in the weeds, I actually think it was a really, really interesting listen, particularly at the top of the meeting where she really outlined what her philosophy was about the Medicaid program and about sort of anti-poverty programs generally. And she linked it back to her own experience early in her career working in public health. And, you know, Seema Verma obviously has made a number of speeches in which she's articulated these views. And I don't think that anything she said was inconsistent with some of the regulatory language that has come out of CMS and things that she said in public. But to me, at least, it just felt much more kind of personal. And I don't know, I thought it was very interesting tape. And because it's available to the public, I just recommend listening to it.
And we'll go ahead and post the link on the web, on the podcast page. I was mostly interested in this because of what Alice was saying about Candace, which didn't happen, the announcement of the rejection. But I wanted to talk just for a minute about the idea of having limits on, you know, time limits on Medicaid coverage, which is something that they, you know, Congress did in the 1990s for welfare, but this has never been for Medicaid. And you were saying, you know, it could violate the Medicaid statute because this was some of the discussion. The Medicaid statute is about improving people's health care, and it's hard to see how taking their health care away improves their health care. But Kansas is one of five states that are looking to impose these lifetime limits on Medicaid. And I wonder, you know, is that something you think they're going to do and then let it all play out in the courts?
So Seema Verma didn't give a definitive answer on this, but she did say that CMS understands that people's life circumstances change over time. And just because you get a job and it may have health care, it doesn't mean you might not lose that job later and need to go back on Medicaid.
Or even just lose hours.
Yes.
I mean, that's a common thing. People churn mm-hmm. back and forth because, you know, now they're eligible again because they've had their hours cut.
Right. And so a 3-year lifetime limit doesn't take that into account at all.
It also seems to me kind of categorically different than the work requirement or the community engagement requirement, because that, as the administration describes it, is supposed to be essentially an incentive and a way for the program to push people out of poverty, to say, we're going to give you these health benefits, but we expect you to be engaged in the community, to go out into the world and work or volunteer or do something like that. And the reason why they support that is they say they want to push people on track to leave poverty, to get work skills, to get work experience, to eventually build up their income and go to a job that has health insurance. If you think about the circumstances that lead people to rely on Medicaid coverage, we know that most people in Medicaid already work, and many of them already work full-time jobs. Part of the reason why Medicaid is such an important safety net for health insurance coverage for low-income people is because a lot of those kinds of jobs don't come with health benefits. And so a lifetime limit would actually catch and prevent people from getting coverage, a lot of people who are essentially adhering to the overall goals of the program. So they're doing what they're supposed to do to get themselves out of poverty. They're working, maybe they're working a full-time job, but their employer doesn't offer them benefits, and we don't have a really good system for helping those people get a different kind of public insurance, because Obamacare only offer subsidies to people above a certain income threshold. The idea is that Medicaid would help people below.
And of course, the reason for that is that when the Affordable Care Act was written, the Medicaid expansion was supposed to be mandatory. So there wasn't going to be a gap because every state would expand. So if you weren't eligible for the subsidies to buy private insurance, you were eligible for Medicaid. Of course, that hasn't happened. And now in 19 states, there's people who fall into this gap where they're not eligible for anything.
Right. And the work requirements has been that's sort of been the debate and the attention and the news coverage. Where the switch to, and CMS clearly isn't ready to go there. They, you know, they might be in a week, but right now they did not. They had an opportunity to allow the lifetime limits, and they have not yet done so. And we will just have to. There's clearly concern. If she loved them, we would have heard that by now. You know, there's a long list of things that Seema Verma. I mean, from the moment she took her job last year, it was a letter last March, and there's a lot of things she mentioned that she wanted to change. And I don't think I've ever heard her endorse. Maybe I'm wrong. Has anyone ever heard her endorse lifetime limits?
I have not.
No, and I do think the sort of life circumstances change argument that she made about why this is a complex issue yesterday, that is not unlike welfare. I mean, I think it is worth remembering we do have, you know, lifetime limits for welfare in many states, and people do fall in and out of work, fall in and out of poverty, but there was a view, you know, among policymakers that it was still worth having a hard cutoff. I think the real question here is not just whether people's life circumstances change, but is health care and is the goal of the Medicaid statute, which is to provide health care and health insurance to people, is that different than cash assistance?
We'll find out. Well, let's move on. Also in the news this week, Title 10, the federal family planning program. Even though the program has never directly paid for abortion, it became law back in 1970 before abortion was legal nationwide. The program has long been caught up in abortion politics. Yesterday, Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, and the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association, which represents Title 10 clinics, filed suit in federal court. They claim the Trump administration's trying to rewrite the rules for the program as part of a funding announcement that seems to make it easier for agencies that don't offer all forms of birth control to get federal family planning money. It's all pretty arcane, but this is still a big part of the defund Planned Parenthood politics. Yes? Alice, you're nodding.
Yes, there's a fear that what has happened in terms of international health funding from the federal government, the so-called global gag rule, is going to turn into a domestic gag rule. The term gag being denying funding to organizations that refer people or
counsel
for abortion. And so there's a fear that it could lead to defunding organizations like Planned Parenthood that provide both abortions and other forms of reproductive health care.
And should point out that a lot of Planned Parenthoods don't provide abortion services, but they do all, I mean, they're, and this is currently a requirement in the Title 10 program that a woman with an unintended pregnancy should be counseled on all of her options, including prenatal care, adoption, and pregnancy termination. That's written into the guidelines for Title 10. The gag rule, the domestic gag rule that Alice is talking about goes back to 1987, and I confess it was the first reproductive health issue I ever covered. It raged for 5 years. It was ultimately, that the rule was ultimately upheld by the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision, but it never took effect because they were still fighting about it when Bill Clinton took office in 1993 and made it go away. I was actually surprised it never came back during the George W. Bush administration. So I'm not all that surprised now that it's being talked about. And there was, I guess, a letter this week from, 85 anti-abortion groups, 41 Senate Republicans, and more than 150 House Republicans calling for its return. So I think...
Well, it's another one of these expectations from conservatives that they have control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. And Vice President Pence and some of the White House personnel are very, very, very closely identified with the anti-abortion movement. And, you know, they sort of, they're part of the base, thought that defunding Planned Parenthood was a slam dunk. And, you know, it wasn't. It isn't. It hasn't been defunded. There's a shift in policy. There's an emphasis on abstinence. But checks are still being written to Planned Parenthood. And people don't, you know, they want action.
My political question, though, is that if they were to do this, and having now covered abortion for, 30-some years, it tends to be whichever side wins, the other side gets energized. So if they actually succeeded in putting through this rule and defunding Planned Parenthood, and I think one of the reasons they want to do it is because they're worried about a big, blue wave in November and they want to motivate the Republican base, wouldn't it more motivate the Democratic base that's already motivated?
Well, they need to motivate. This probably isn't going to, Congress is not going to defund Planned Parenthood between now and November, right? They don't have
because
the
votes. They would need 60 votes
close.
In the Senate,
not
which they don't have.
So for the conservatives to be talking about in a climate in which the conservatives are very worried about losing control of the House, it behooves them. They're not thinking that far, Julie. I mean, just they want to talk about more and more and more and more. I mean, yeah. And Title 10, people aren't going to totally understand it. I mean, they want to vote. No more money for Planned Parenthood.
Right.
Let's cut off Planned Parenthood. And they want an explicit vote, and they're not going to get it. But we're going to hear a lot from both sides. People have always been energized on this issue. Sometimes, some years, they're more energized than others. And also, we're fighting about contraception now, not just abortion. And that I don't think that has been quite this politically salient for a while.
Although it's interesting because we've been fighting about contraception for a long time. It just hasn't been so obvious.
Right.
Aside from the political question about the effect of this, I think there are some practical considerations to think about, too. If Planned Parenthood was really defunded or substantially defunded through Title 10 or through Medicaid, some of the different ways that Republicans would like to defund them, I think there would be a real shortage of the availability of women's health providers in a lot of states, even in places that don't really like Planned Parenthood. There's been quite a lot of research that suggests that there just aren't enough other people who could take the money, who could take up the excess patients. And that may not be a permanent problem. I think, you know, obviously, if there is this gap and there are people who are committed to providing these services, like they will find a way and new practices. You know, maybe Planned Parenthood will even reorganize itself in some way. But in the short term, I do think that if Planned Parenthood can no longer access these federal funds to supply these services, that there will be a lot of women who need a lot of reproductive health help, not abortion, but contraception and counseling and other kinds of things, who really are going to struggle to find someone that will take care of them.
And we saw that on the ground in Texas when Texas right. cut off Planned Parenthood, tried
there
to do
gaps.
Their own.
It's a couple of years and there's still gaps.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, we still have more to cover. In the strange news of the week, Donald Trump's former doctor, Howard Bornstein, told NBC that shortly after the president took office, one of the president's lawyers and his head of security raided the doctor's office and took the president's medical files. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, responding to the story, called it, quote, standard operating procedure to remove the medical records to the White House medical unit. I covered the passage of HIPAA, the federal medical records privacy law. That is not how it is supposed to work.
Well, I mean, I think that, A, none of us were surprised to see Dr. Bornstein back in the news. We've been sort of waiting for his moment.
We've been hoping.
And, you know, he's in the news for two reasons. One is he now claims that Trump wrote that letter saying he was the healthiest person in the history of the human race or whatever. the healthiest president ever, and ever would be. So he's had a double whammy of news exposure.
Although Bornstein did note that most of the other presidents are dead.
Anyhow, you know, like even
George
for the
Washington
Trump era, he stands out. There's actually some hilarious stuff on, you know, when I was on the metro over here, there's some hilarious stuff on Twitter about people complaining when they try to hire goons to get their medical records. Their insurer says it's out of network goons and they won't cover it. No, I mean, I don't know what to say about this story. It's like...
So a few things that I will say. So one is just, you know, HIPAA is this law that creates a lot of standards around medical privacy.
It gives you the right to your medical records.
It gives you the right to your medical records.
Exactly.
It gives you a right to a copy of your medical records, not seizing the originals by force from your doctor's office.
Thank you. It also is supposed to protect the transmission of your medical data to people that you don't approve. And so it is true that it appears that Trump's goons have committed a HIPAA violation.
I'm not sure. I like to call them goons. I think they're bodyguards.
One was a bodyguard. One was a lawyer.
Trump's employees may have violated HIPAA by seizing the original copies of these records that are supposed to remain with the physician.
Well, and they belong to the physician.
But Dr. Bornstein appears to have also committed a HIPAA violation when he told the press some of the medications that President Trump was taking, including Propecia, which is a medicine that is sort of a baldness treatment, but also affects men's prostates.
It's the other way around. It's a prostate treatment that also is used for growing hair loss.
Sorry, excuse me. Well, it has both of those functions.
There are no heroes in this story is what we're trying to say. HIPAA violations all around.
I just wanted to make the point of how HIPAA is supposed to work.
But
thank you, Alice.
It
entitles you to a copy of your records, not the originals.
I just wanted to tie
Unless
this back to
guns.
More current events, which is that... those are not all of President Trump's medical records that were seized. And like all of us, our medical records are spread hither and yon. Some of them are on paper. Some of them are in digital systems. The digital systems probably don't talk to one another. You know, the reason why people are making the joke about how hard it is to get your medical records is that we do have a system that for most ordinary people, it is really, really difficult to assemble and share complete medical records in a way that new medical providers can use them. It is an ongoing problem. It is actually a problem that Seema Verma at CMS has made a priority. She is trying to encourage providers to find, you know, to end the vendors of these medical record system to find a way to integrate better, to share better.
Not just between the providers, but also greater patient access because it's their paper, but it's our body.
Yeah. Anyway, I just whenever I come upon these stories about medical records, I just always want to like remind people that someone's, even a, the president's medical records are not like a thing. Even though these guys went to this doctor's office and took certain papers, they did not take President Trump's complete medical records. And even though Dr. Bornstein
more than one doctor
apparently, you know, may have misled the public about the exact status of President Trump's health, it is also important to note that he doesn't necessarily know everything that there is to know about President Trump's health, because President Trump might have gone to another doctor for other problems, and we don't know about those things. So I just remember during the campaign, there was a cry, in fact, from President Trump that Hillary Clinton's medical records should all be released. And I had the same exact kind of friction in my mind at that moment. Like, her medical records are not an entity that can be easily just handed over to the public, even if she wanted to. Too. And I just think it's worth remembering that.
I bet
even
she's
these things that
were organized about it, though. I mean, she knows where they are better than he does.
But it's not like your taxes. You can actually turn over your tax
returns. Your tax returns, that is like one document. It is in a central place, like that exists. Your medical records are just like a big old mess of paper, which anyone who has ever tried to get their vaccination records or even just like get an MRI from one place to another knows.
And Trump never did release his full records. He released the letter and a discussion
that
on
he apparently dictated.
But are you surprised? I mean, no two people could have that syntax.
No, but there's a difference between, oh, no one's surprised that this ridiculous letter bragging about his stamina was self-written and not by an actual doctor on the up and up. But I think it's more than just a silly scandal or punchline that we knew so little about his health before the election.
But I think that was reported at the time. There was a letter. It was on Dr. Oz. It was skimpy. It did not tell the whole story. I mean, people did write at that time that it was not exactly a convincingly thorough examination of an overweight 70-year-old's health.
Joanne's writers, Dan Diamond, wrote at the time where he was talking to a lot of people about this problem. Like, we as the public should care about the health of our presidential candidates, and we need to have some kind of objective, unbiased way to evaluate it. And he talked to a lot of experts who said that perhaps there should be some independent board of doctors that examine each of the presidential candidates and make an independent public evaluation of their health, which would not necessarily be every single medical, you know, doctor's visit in their entire lives. But, you know, like, here's how they are right now. I don't know if that is a great idea, but I thought it was an interesting idea.
But we all, I mean, even with Trump in the presidency, you know, when he supposedly had the neutral, you know, Navy doctor assessment that was supposed to be, you know, he's the president's doctor, but he's also the public's doctor in this.
And he's an admiral, right?
And yeah, and that one didn't turn out too well either.
Yes, I was going to say that the only other person who we've heard from on Trump's health is Dr. Ronny Jackson, who now not only is not going to be the next VA secretary, he's apparently not going to be the president's physician anymore, and he's under investigation
by
the
Pentagon's
investigator
general. Well, if the president listed 200, you all are going to be very embarrassed by your criticism of Dr. Ronny's comments.
Well, we won't be here to be embarrassed.
Unless we all live to turn. All right, one more before we move on.
There's also a slight HIPAA thing going on with Ronny Jackson and Vice President Pence's wife,
yes,
and whether he handled her, Karen Pence's, private medical information correctly. That emerged this week, and we will be hearing more about that.
Yeah, so Ronny Jackson is not out of the woods yet. All right, well, speaking of doctors, Tom Price, the former head of HHS, who left after Joanne's reporters outed his proclivity for private plane travel, gave a speech at a big D.C. health conference this week. We hadn't really heard from him since he left HHS. And he pointed out that Congress's elimination of the individual mandate penalty in the tax bill was likely to hurt the individual insurance market by encouraging healthy people to opt out and leaving the sick behind. Now, that is what most analysts, including the Congressional Budget Office, think, but it is the opposite of the Republican talking points on this subject. And in predictable fashion, he tried to walk it back the next day. My question is, what prompted him to say it in the first place?
I don't know, but Marco Rubio was walking back the tax comment at the same time, and I was worried that they'd run into each other. It was like this moment.
It was like
of
Republicans accidentally tell the truth.
Yeah,
week.
It was like this. We actually have. He has done a few industry speeches, and we've tried to cover them.
Tom Price.
Price, and we had actually sort of tried to cover them. And he, you know, if sometimes you can't get in the room, but you can talk to people. And he had made no news for, you know, ever. So of course, the one day we said, all right, we're not going to go. We're
doing
other things.
Yeah, it was at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, we do things at 8 o'clock in the morning, but we didn't assign an ex secretary. We didn't assign somebody to go to an ex secretary's speech since he hadn't said anything newsworthy in months. And of course, he said that the mandate is essential, basically. And I don't know what was in his mind, but the, you know, and then he did walk it back and say, well, that's why we have all these other, it would adversely affect certain populations and make it more expensive, but that's why we Republicans are going to do these other things like associated health plans and short-term plans. So he tried to put it in the larger context. It was pretty
wild.
Who he's
been talking to, you know, since he left office, and what kinds of job opportunities he is considering for the future.
Right. I mean, I think it makes perfect sense if he's more on the industry side now, because the industry is freaking out about this. And
well, the insurance industry. Well, yeah, exactly. It's true, I guess the rest of them.
Yeah, no. I mean, AHIP and everybody else, has, not everybody else, but many industry players have been saying exactly what he said, that the repeal of the individual mandate, the availability of these skimpy plans are all adversely affecting the individual market, including the insurance companies that provide plans there. And so it makes sense that now he's not on the political side and more on the industry side, or looking to transition into the industry side, would say that. And the walk back only came after Democrats in Congress seized on the comments and were dunking on him and saying, see, everyone.
And also, it reminded me, I know we went back down memory lane recently, but just indulge me for a minute, when we were talking about the prongs. So when Republicans were talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act,
the buckets.
Yes, the buckets, the prongs. I like the prongs. But,
the weight, Margo.
The ways they were going to undo the ACA.
But there was phases. A view, okay.
We better explain that.
Yeah, I'm going to. That the Obamacare repeal was one piece of the strategy that they were going to pursue. So they were going to take away things like the individual mandate and other money-related things in the health law. Then they were going to do a bunch of regulatory changes, including things like short-term plans, association health plans, which they're doing now. But then there was this third prong or third bucket of the strategy, which is they were going to then come back and do new legislation that was going to sort of deal with some of the problems that resulted from changing the financial incentives but not changing the overall regulatory regime of insurance. So there was an idea that, like, if we're still going to have guaranteed issue and essential health benefits and community rating and all of these other sort of what Republicans consider to be onerous regulations of insurance, and then you take away some of the subsidies and you take away the individual mandate, that you're going to kind of wreck that market. And so what they need to do is re-regulate that. And so in this small way, I think his comments this week were roughly consistent with the overall strategy that he was pursuing as part of the administration in trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which is to say, repealing the individual mandate alone and doing nothing else was never their stated strategy. They knew that that would create problems. I think he just was a little bit more straightforward and frank about the kinds of problems that it would cause in this context.
And that's also assuming that bucket three or whatever we're calling it is possible. And many members of Congress and many people were saying all along that it isn't possible. You can't do repeal through reconciliation and then hope magically later you can do replace.
Which would need 60 votes in the Senate.
Which would need 60 votes in the Senate.
I think they were hoping, I mean, I think their strategy was
take a hostage?
That it was, you know, once you repeal a big chunk of it, the system wouldn't work very well and that you would have gotten some moderate Senate votes.
So essentially, take a hostage, break it, and then people will be more motivated to vote to fix it.
And but as it
Trump
turns
has
out,
said
right.
that a number of times. He said exactly
right.
that.
But also, as it turns out, the regulatory prime bucket, whatever it is, turned out to be where we are. And they've done a lot of damage to they have not repealed Obamacare. But as we've talked about every single week, it is not as healthy as it could be. And it's mostly through the regulatory and other inactions.
All right,
regulatory actions and marketing
I'm
inactions.
I'm so excited I got to say prongs again.
All right, well, I think we're going to stop
I'm
there.
I'm going to get you a fork for your next birthday.
Those are times.
All right, you're right.
All right, we're going to stop for the news of the week. We're going to go to our interview, then we'll come back and talk about our extra credit stories. So while I was in Boston earlier in the week, I was on a panel with Robert Blendon, who holds joint appointments at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and its School of Public Health. Bob is a polling expert who specialized in the politics of health over several decades, and I was pleased to be able to ask him about the complicated politics of 2018. So here's the interview. Some people have been saying for a while that this coming midterm election will be the first since 2006 where healthcare hasn't been one of the central issues. Others say that healthcare will be a driving force for voters in the fall. Who's right?
They're both right. So the driving issue will be a referendum on the president. And when the polls come out, it'll say, that a lot of people voted for Congress because they were or against him. Then there are going to be a set of issues that people say were important. They weren't dominant, the referendum. Healthcare will be one of the top two or three issues. But the important thing, it will not be around the operation of the ACA. Some people are just too close to this. It's going to be about principles. So what happened in the debate to repeal the bill, there was a dramatic increase among Democrats and independents on a belief that we should never take coverage away from 24 million people. And they're angry. And they just want to make sure whoever's elected to the House or Senate doesn't come back and try to take 24 million. But they actually don't know very much about what's happened in the last year for it. A much smaller number of Republicans are still hanging in. But again, it's about principles. They don't like the idea the federal government will end up managing health insurance and medicine health care. And they don't think we can afford it. So when they actually say health care is an issue, it's not about what happened to the exchanges last month or anything else. It's they would like something that's smaller and doesn't have the federal government. So the story will be it is a referendum, but among issues, health care is likely to be there, principally because these Democratic-oriented voters actually want to punish somebody for the town halls and the marches and the stories about kids with cerebral palsy not being able to get coverage when they're adults. There are a lot of angry people out there for that, and that will show up. But the overall election is a referendum. Do you vote for people who will support the president or not in the next 2 years?
Is this a mirror image of 2010 when the Republicans, you know, after all the angry town hall meetings of people opposing the Affordable Care Act, and then the Republicans, interestingly, mostly ran on the Medicare cuts in the ACA, and the Republicans, as we know, took over the House?
People missed about 2010. There was a referendum on President Obama, and it was quite mixed. And the referendum, which was tied to health care, was we were in the biggest economic downturn since the Great Depression. A lot of voters thought he got his priorities wrong. He shouldn't be running around trying to build these big health care when businesses are closing, people can't get loans. So there was an anger about his priorities, and there was a scared about what this ACA thing meant. Even though people like the idea of universal coverage, there it can get very practical when you get down the policies. What happens to my family, my neighborhood, my business? And this bill scared them. So the two about how come you're working on this when the plants are closing, and what I've heard about it scares me, really it led to a referendum where, in fact, the Republicans took over. And the focus on Medicare is always important because seniors have gone from the most Democratic-leaning group to many of them now leaning Republican. And so protecting Medicare turns out to be on both sides a very important issue for what a swing group who turn out in off-year elections could care about.
So what do we think we know about what voters want from healthcare right now? You said it's a very sort of broad brush thing.
The problem is that people are tied up more broadly in the principle side. And the activists in the Democratic Party are going to shock everyone. They are really going to be pushing for some sort of a government, a single payer. And it's around fairness and equity. They're not into how to fix the cost issue and everything. They just think the same card and same benefits for everybody is very fair. Also, the next generation has not a lot of love for for-profit insurance companies. For that. And on the Republican side, it's going to be repealing and tearing out root and all is gone. But some alternative which leaves people covered, that's less expensive, and it's run by states, is really going to be the big political issues. Everyone thinks costs are a problem, and that will be politically with us. But the problem of the cost issue, solving it, threatens not only doctors and hospitals, it threatens a number of middle income people when they hear their benefits will be capped, they'll be limited, they can only go to certain networks. So the cost issue has a real downside because the solutions don't sound right to a large number of people. So it'll be the top issue, but it's very tough to find a political solution that at the end of the day makes voters feel better about you.
What would we have to do to get to a point where the electorate could make a statement about health care that lawmakers could then act on?
We're going to continue to have two sets of debates. And one debate will be elections, which are general principles. Where do we want to go? More government, less government, more action. And then we're going to have, after the election, depending on the mix, a debate of where we go next. But the issue is this country is more polarized politically. It's not just on health care, on almost every domestic issue. So the nature of the debate just cannot take forward unless one party is dominant or another. So it requires a change, and people don't want to go back and remember that when Medicare was enacted, LBJ had the biggest liberal sweep in my lifetime history for that. And this could happen in the next presidential election or a more conservative sweep. But you have to start with where the majority parties really are. And then you really are going to focus on what individual policies are. The dilemma is if you look beneath the surface, it's very hard to get bipartisan support on anything but medical research. We just have lost the ability to talk to each other across party lines. So a lot of the big changes will occur if one party ends up in a cycle. Dominant, they will move in one direction and if they in the other. But these debates are not over because the Democrats are not happy with we're just going to fix the ACA, which if you talk to policy experts, they're all in the if we only adjusted this or that or for that. And particularly in the presidential election, they're going to find people running in the primaries flat out by saying, let's do something big, let's do something real, while the others are saying, no, I just want to subsidize the exchanges. That doesn't make good election talk.
Yeah, that was my next question, which is that we've talked a lot on this podcast about internal divisions among Democrats, single payer versus sort of more incremental among Republicans about, you know, pull out the ACA root and branch or leave the popular parts and just repeal the rest. Which party is more divided on this?
Both parties are divided. The Democrats passionately care about this issue, but the next wave of Democrats who are quite active, liberal, younger, they want a big change from the private insurance side. The Republicans are divided, but they have taken such a beating in the last session, and particularly if they lose seats around this, there will be an effort to find something that is credible that they can live with. A continuing battle between the far-out conservatives and people in moderates will guarantee they're in the minority party for a number of 40 years. So I do believe by the time we hit 2020, you're going to be surprised there'll be some interim bill. In my view, it's going to look like a modified Graham-Cassidy bill, which gives states an awful lot of authority. And the trade-off is you're not going to take coverage away from 24 million people. It may be skimpier, more choices, but they're going to have a larger bill. But because we're likely to have this big primary on the Democratic side, people are going to be taken back because for a year, the more liberal candidates are just going to start out with single payer. And they're not going to want to have a discussion about fixing the ACA. And that's really going to catch mainstream Democrats because what do I do about this? And my view is they may have to consider something that's attractive, buying into Medicare or something, that says I am not for just fixing exchanges for insurers for five more years. We have another alternative, but it doesn't leave the federal government providing insurance to everybody. But it's going to be a much bigger debate than anybody can imagine who thinks this is all settled now that the ACA is limping, but it's still there.
Is this the most divided since you've been doing this, 30-some years? Is this the most divided the electorate has been on health care while health care has been sort of a prominent issue?
So they have been divided. The thing that is different is that the electorate has divided, if you look at the Pew polls, on 7 to 10 domestic issues. They're now 15 to 20 points apart. So it makes it harder to find an agreement. If all I disagree with you as a Republican or Democrat is health care, maybe we can find something in the middle. But it turns out I don't agree with you on taxes. I don't agree with you on welfare. I don't agree with you on foreign aid. And you just go down these lists. So there's not a lot of incentive for the next generation of Republicans and Democrats to find one issue to agree on. So these divisions are very, very real, and I think we're going to have cycles where the dominant party is going to shape health policy. And the risk is if you're in the 20-year thinking, the other party can come in and make some pretty dramatic changes for it. But I don't see a consensus. I just see if one party is in the majority, they will push health care because it's important to their voters. But it won't look the same. There's just no Lyndon Johnson hugging some number of Republicans who voted for the Medicare bill. I don't think we're going to see that in the future.
The debate will continue.
Yes.
Robert Blendon, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, too.
Okay, now it's time for our extra credit segment. That's where each of us recommends a health story they read recently they think everyone else should read, too. Don't worry if you miss one. We will post the links to these stories on the podcast page at khn.org. Who wants to go first? Joanne.
There was a really good piece in the Times this week in the New York Times by Abby Goodenough. Injecting drugs can ruin a heart. How many second chances should a user get? And it's a complex story. Basically, drug users, meth as well as opioids and other things can end up with these life-threatening heart valve infections. Endocarditis is the technical word. It's complicated, dangerous, and expensive to treat. They can get reinfected. The survival rate's not great, and there are doctors grappling with how often do you repair them. And there was a focus in this story about one doctor who's trying to say, you don't just repair the heart, you've got to get them into treatment and give them a shot at getting clean and getting healthy. And it's a complicated bioethics coverage, opioids, everything in the mix story.
It's almost like giving organ transplants to,
right.
You know, or liver transplants.
They said there was a quote in the story. It's like giving a liver transplant to a guy drinking a fifth of vodka while you operate. Yeah, that was sort of the.
Margo.
I wanted to mention a story that ran in Politico this week from Arthur Allen about a friend of the president's who is a Mar-a-Lago member and a physician named Dr. Bruce Moskowitz. And Dr. Moskowitz apparently is unhappy with the medical records system that Cerner has provided to the hospitals that he practices in Florida. And as a result, he has personally intervened to try to prevent the Veterans Administration from completing an $18 billion acquisition of a medical records system from the same vendor. And it's just a really incredible story of how this person who is close to the president has interfered with this major, major federal procurement contract that, in fact, was initiated at the behest of other people in the White House. And, you know, it appears that many of his complaints about the system are actually not even remotely relevant to the system that the Veterans Administration wants to buy, that it just so happens that his hospitals use a different version of the software that has fewer features.
And out of date, it hasn't been upgraded. Right. So it's a couple years old, it hasn't been upgraded.
And we should point out, he's been on the conference calls, the official conference calls where they're discussing, you know, trying to make this happen. This is one of those stories that you literally could not make up. If you were to write this as fiction, it would be rejected because nobody would believe it.
And it's exactly what people feared when the focus was on this club membership sort of system at the president's businesses where people could pay a great sum of money to have this kind of access and this kind of sway in major national public policy.
But what's fun about this one? Electronic health records onto MSNBC.
Right. I feel like, you know, like this guy isn't trying to enrich his own company. You know, there's not graft exactly. It's just like he happens to have personal strong opinions about this thing.
Sure, but he couldn't communicate those personal strong opinions to the president of the United States if he wasn't a paying member of
Absolutely.
This club.
And as regular listeners know, we get really excited when we can say a story is crazy pants. And this one,
this one is crazy pants.
This
one is crazy pants. All right, Alice, you're just a little more staid.
A little more sad over here. So there's a great new report out of the Commonwealth Fund tracking the number of people who are uninsured, and it is up a lot since the administration came into power in 2016. There's about 4 million more people of working age who are uninsured, and they attribute it to the administration's policies, among them slashing outreach for open enrollment, cutting the length of open enrollment, repealing the individual mandate like we just talked about, and they predict that even more. The numbers of people without insurance will continue to climb in 2019 because of those factors and because of the availability of these skimpy plans, which will raise premiums for the comprehensive plans and price people out of the market, et cetera. Interestingly, they found that, well, this is to be expected, but the rates are climbing much more in states that did not expand Medicaid, which are Republican states. And so under a Republican president, many more Republicans are uninsured.
Just a word of caution, which is that there are a couple of different organizations that have been measuring this using surveys, and there hasn't been complete convergence on what the trend is. So I do think this Commonwealth Fund survey is worth thinking about, and certainly the results seem consistent with like approximately what our expectations might be given the policy environment. But I think we have to keep our eyes open. There are a couple of government surveys coming out in the next few months that will either confirm or conflict with this and give us probably a sort of deeper picture of what's going on with the uninsured rate.
Yeah. And we'll talk about those when they happen. Mine is similarly kind of a peek into the present as a way to look at the future. It's from my Kaiser Health News colleague, Rachel Bluth. It's called Peak Health Plan Premiums Give Rise to Activism and Unconventional Solutions. It's about how there's just one insurer serving Charlottesville, Virginia right now, and the price of them to come back into the market was that the premiums are sky high. So this one family moved in with their college student daughter in Richmond so they could buy insurance there. I think the college student daughter was not so thrilled with this. And I'm highlighting this piece because right now there's only a few places like Charlottesville where there's just one insurer and the premiums are unaffordable for a lot of people. But that's likely to change next year for all the reasons that we've been talking about, the elimination of the individual mandate, the possibility of short-term plans and association health plans. So I think most people are expecting to see far more places with only one insurer and unaffordable premiums. So we may see more parents moving in with their college children.
And that is also
a
region that only has one very dominant health system, the University of Virginia medical system health. And so you have one insurer and one dominant provider network and hospital. So it was not a happy.
Yeah, that's not a good prescription for competition and lower prices.
But also it also plays into the current very heated debate about expanding Medicaid in Virginia, which would not necessarily sweep up and help all of these families.
It would not help this family, but there are a lot.
But it could help hundreds of thousands.
Yes, there are. Yeah,
but I just want to note that moving is probably not going to be a viable solution for most people who are in very expensive insurance markets. And in fact, what we've seen is that very few people have moved, or it appears that very few people have moved, even who live very close to state borders, in order to take advantage of a Medicaid expansion. So there are plenty of places where, like, on one side of the line, there is no Medicaid expansion. On the other side, there is. It doesn't look like people are really moving to take advantage of that. And so while this family has found a creative solution, probably the more likely outcome is that there just are going to be people who are going to be priced out of the market and still kind of stuck there.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, on that note, that is it for today. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We'd also appreciate it if you left us a review on iTunes. That will help other people find us, too. Also, as usual, you can email us if you have questions or comments. We're at whatthehealth, all one word, at kff.org. Or you can tweet me. I'm at Jay Rovner.
I'm at Joanne Kennan.
At Sanger Katz.
At Alice Olstein.
We'll be back in your feed next week. In the meantime, be healthy.